This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Melissa McCarthy, is known for her comic roles in movies like Bridesmaids and The Heat, and for her impersonation of President Trump's first press secretary, Sean Spicer, on Saturday Night Live. Now she takes a different direction in the new film Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is based on the 2008 memoir of the same name by Lee Israel. Israel, who died in 2014, had a moderately successful career writing biographies of people who had fallen out of the popular consciousness, like actress Tallulah Bankhead and gossip columnist Dorothy Kilgallen. But after her biography of Estée Lauder flopped, she couldn't find a publisher for her next book about vaudeville star Fanny Brice. Finding herself broke, unable to pay her rent or her cat's vet bill, Israel deployed her writing skills to forge letters by literary luminaries like Dorothy Parker, Edna Ferber, Noel Coward, and the actress Louise Brooks, and sold the letters to collectors. Reviewing the film in the New York Times, A.O. Scott wrote, "Lee Israel may be the single most interesting movie character you will encounter this year." Let's start with a clip from the film in which Israel confides her secret to Jack Hawk, a fellow alcoholic who scrapes by on charm, wit, and numerous scams and hustles. Jack is played by Richard E. Grant. Each of these characters has an acerbic sense of humor.
Can you keep a secret?
I've no one to tell. All my friends are dead.
Quite by accident, I find myself in a rather criminal position.
I can't fathom what criminal activity could possibly involve you, except a crime of fashion, of course.
I'm in embellishing documents, if you will.
Are you forging checks?
No. Literary letters by prominent writers.
Not checks, not money, just letters.
You're not understanding the world of elite, collectible, literary artifacts.
No, I suppose not. But how thrilling to be forging pieces of paper that go where? Libraries?
No, I am selling to collectors.
How much are you getting for them?
I don't know why I told you. It's a waste of a secret. I should have gone out there and gotten a rock and told the rock because I'd get a better response.
Who else have you told about this?
You're not the only one without friends.
Melissa McCarthy, welcome to Fresh Air. I love you in this new movie, so congratulations on it. This is a really different role for you. You play somebody who is very funny in a caustic, sarcastic, bitter way. But I wouldn't call the movie a comedy, and there isn't any physical comedy in it, and you're very known for physical comedy. So I know you start in St. Vincent in a dramatic role, but do you consider this movie a new direction for you?
I think it's a new direction for how I think most people are used to seeing me. I was in New York for many, many years doing dramatic plays, so I'm quite comfortable, and I always kind of think if you put all the things I've done together, I may have even done more drama than comedy in its totality, but I do realize most people haven't seen a lot of that. It was incredibly far off Broadway plays. So, you know, the 13 people at each performance don't have much impact.
So I skimmed through the memoir because, you know, the movie's based on a memoir by Lee Israel.
Yes.
So I might have missed this. But you don't really get a sense of who she is physically, what she looks like. And I don't think there's a lot of insights into her personality. So where did you go for those insights? And did you have a sense of what she looked like?
No, there's, you know, true to Lee's personality, there is not a lot of her personal life to get to take a look at. And also it's before everyone felt the need to document, you know, every single moment of their lives. And I was lucky enough, though, that two of our producers, David Yarnell, had known her for 20 years. He was, you know, had a very big part in kind of poking and prodding her to even write the memoir, which he, you know, says she was very difficult about. Again, true to Lee's kind of caustic, prickly nature. She didn't want to write about herself. She didn't like the idea of it and finally did, which worked out well for her. But and Carrie, another of our producers, knew her for 10 years. So I really just kind of sat and listened to their stories and listened to, you know, how difficult yet to me always so witty and kind of fascinating she was. So I got a lot of the characters from that. And then the rest, you know, I kind of conjured and created.
Something I thought was a very telling detail about Lee Israel's personality is that she had a 21-year-old cat who was, like, infirm and addled and living under the bed. And her apartment was infested with flies.
Yeah.
And she writes, I found no connection between the flies and my cat's litter box, although it should have been clear that she was doing what my grandma Lena used to call her business under my bed, and her business was attracting flies. I did not smell anything, rather like those serial killers who garnish their flats with hacked off human parts, but never seem bothered by or even aware of the stench. And I can't help but wonder, like, you see in the film that the hole underneath her bed, it's just covered with cat poo. And she's totally unaware of it. But when someone else walks in the apartment, they have to leave because it smells so much. So you had to ask yourself, right, when you were playing her, like, how could she not have noticed?
Well, how far into denial, and there was such an inner, I thought, you know, there was such an inner spiral for Lee in terms of just shutting down and pushing people away and going inward, and so much played, there seemed to be such a struggle, an interior struggle for her, and so much kind of anger and frustration. And it was at a point in her life where the one thing she could do, which was write, and she was a great writer, she was being told she was obsolete. And I think she was just no longer, you know, just as though, in the same way that she was not flexible or capable enough of simply starting a new career or even getting a job and just dealing with people, she did not have that ability. She could only do the one thing. And I think the more her life spiraled out, the less she could, you know, see what was literally right there in front of her. It's like, you know, I think there's a thing when people kind of just start to barricade on the interior of themselves, that they're, you know, you do truly become in denial of what's right in front of your face.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Melissa McCarthy, and she stars in the new movie, Can You Ever Forgive Me? So I want to ask you about something you did so well, which is playing Sean Spicer on Saturday Night Live, President Trump's first press secretary, who had a very oppositional relationship with the press. So here's to say the least. Here's your first outing as Sean Spicer on Saturday Night Live.
Now I'd like to begin today by apologizing on behalf of you to me for how you have treated me these last 2 weeks. And that apology is not accepted. Because I'm not here to be your buddy. I'm here to swallow gum, and I'm here to take Nate. Okay, now let me wave something shiny in front of you monkeys. As you know, President Trump announced his Supreme Court pick on the national TV today. When he entered the room, the crowd greeted him with a standing ovation, which lasted a full 15 minutes. And you can check the tape on that. Everyone was smiling. Everyone was happy. The men all had erections. And every single one of the women was ovulating left and right. And no one was sad. Okay, those are the facts forever, and there's something else. Now, under the president's schedule for today at 3:45, the president will host an encore screening of Finding Dory. Okay, the story of a forgetful fish, okay? Everybody likes that. Then at 6 p.m. he's gonna abolish the national park system. But Dory, good stuff.
That's so great.
Oh, my God.
That's Melissa McCarthy and Sean Spicer. What do you think listening back to it?
It's strange to hear back. I forgot just kind of how truly absurd it was, and yet kind of true to form, which is also rattling.
I always wanted to know, whose idea was it for you to play Spicer? Did they call you? Did Saturday Night Live folks call you and ask you to do it, or did you suggest the idea to them?
No, I did not suggest it. I would never, ever have thought of that in a million years. My friend Kent Sublett, that's one of the head writers at SNL, he called and said, would you ever come in and do Spicer? I wrote something that I think you can play. And I was like, what? The what? I can't play him. I don't do impersonations. I'm not a man. I have no interest. It's not in my wheelhouse. And he just kept saying, you know, I think you could do it. I think, you know, just come in. Can I send it to you to read? And I think I said, oh, I don't think it's quite my thing. And then I believe the next day I saw another rather, you know, insane press conference where I thought, well, this is weirder than anything I could actually do. Like, we can't even match it on SNL. It's so absurd. And I just thought, okay, I'm going to come in and read it and talk to you guys about it. And, you know, I think, and then the real humbling blow is I thought, well, how long is it going to take? Like, can we even get me to look like him? And the really lovely special effects guy there just said, oh, yeah, that's not going to be hard at all. That'll take like a half an hour. Which I thought, oh, I thought it might be harder to switch over to a balding man, but it really wasn't. And they got it down to like, you know, at one point we were doing it in like, you know, 15 minutes. But I just thought, I think I got the feel. I started to think maybe it's time to kind of hold the mirror up and see if anyone realizes how kind of ridiculous they're being.
My guest is Melissa McCarthy. She's starring in the new film Can You Ever Forgive Me as a writer turned literary forger. We'll talk more after a break, and Kevin Whitehead will review a new reissue of music Nino Rota composed for Federico Fellini movies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Melissa McCarthy. She co-starred in Bridesmaids, starred in The Heat, and now stars in the new film Can You Ever Forgive Me as a biographer turned literary forger. It's based on a memoir by Lee Israel. Melissa McCarthy, something else that you're famous for is insults. Insulting
people. Oh, no.
Not in real life. Maybe in real life. I wouldn't know.
No.
I don't know you
in
that way.
I can assure you not.
But the most famous example of that is in This Is 40. And there's a feud between your teenage kid and Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann's teenage kid. And this becomes a feud between the three parents. And they're all called in to meet with the principal. And the other couple, the Leslie Mann-Paul Rudd couple, have threatened you. So you're all just kind of going at each other in the office. So
yes.
Let's hear that scene. It starts with you.
These people are liars. He said that my son was an animal and that if I didn't keep him on a leash, that he would hit him with his car.
Did you say that?
That's ridiculous. Who talks like that?
You do.
He didn't say that.
All right,
he
you
said
know,
it to
no,
me.
What I said was that we need to keep an extra eye on our kids because with all the technological advances, they need to learn to use them responsibly.
No. What he said to me was he called me
a what?
Language, Catherine. Language.
I'm quoting. How am I going to relay what these two nutballs said to me unless I say it?
Can you please not talk like that, Catherine? Music Man is rehearsing next door.
Sorry, Music Man. Maybe if I looked more like this fake couple. Looks like they're in a bank commercial. That's what you look like. Like you're a bank commercial couple.
None of this talk is productive.
I would like to rear up and jackknife my legs and kick you both in the jaw with my foot bone.
You're just really scaring me.
This is what happens when you corner a rat. You corner me, I will chew through you. I'll chew through you.
Okay. And then as the credits roll at the end of This Is 40, it's just you kind of improvising insults in that scene. And it just goes like on and on with more over-the-top insults. Is that something that you're famous for outside, like in the real world, being able to do really funny insults?
No, I do not go around insulting people, I hope, ever. But the first time I watched that back, I kept saying, I didn't say that. Oh, God, I would never say that. And the person I was sitting with said, we're watching you say it. You said all of it. And I didn't remember saying most of it, which made me feel slightly crazy. And I was just trying to say anything that came off the very top of my head. I hadn't planned anything. So, you know, maybe it was just that, so much kind of free word association that I didn't kind of log it into my memory.
Melissa McCarthy, at what point did you start thinking about either acting or comedy? Which came first, like acting or comedy? By comedy, I mean stand-up.
Stand-up came first and kind of suddenly, and I moved to New York when I was 20, kind of out of the blue. I had been living in Boulder, Colorado, not sure exactly what I was doing or why I was even there. I'd moved there with my sister, and then just it was still kind of lingering. And had a friend come and see me and say, "Why are you in Boulder?" Like, and I said, "I don't know. I only want to be in New York." So 3 days later, I moved to New York City. And our first night, he said, "You're going to do an open mic night tomorrow night." And I said, "All right." I went up on stage the second night I was in New York, and I kind of thought, "Oh, I think this is what I'm going to do." And I remember calling my parents saying, "I'm not going to go back to school." I had planned on finishing up at FIT. I hadn't finished school.
That's the Fashion Institute.
Yes, and I wanted to do women's clothing. It's kind of all I had kind of ever thought about from, you know, my grandmother was a seamstress. Maybe that was embedded in me, but I loved making clothes. I loved watching other designers, studying what they did. I loved the whole process. I was always sketching. And then I did stand-up one night, and I just thought, I think I'm going to go this direction.
So did you perform at gay clubs?
The Duplex was one of my favorite places to perform. I just loved it. Also because, you know, the heckling wasn't there. When you went into a regular comedy club, you weren't even fully up on stage yet, and there's always somebody like, "Take your top off." And you're just like, "What? Like, what are you talking? Like, does that ever work for you? Has any woman ever been like, 'Oh my God, I wasn't thinking of it, but you know what? I'm going to take my top off.'" Like, it just, but every time, or something in that vein, and especially when you're starting out, you have, you know, you have 4.5 minutes. And the only way to stop someone from yelling and heckling is you have to really shut them down, like truly shut them down. Not just like, "Okay, buddy, you know, got it." They're going to keep doing it. So in order to actually make them be quiet, I felt I had to get so mean and so cutting and actually really make the person so embarrassed that they stopped talking.
What was one of your favorite insults that you gave on stage in response to a heckler?
Oh, God. I don't think it was my favorite. I think the more it worked, the more I hated it. It usually would dissolve into some kind of thing about, "Oh, you're here with your girlfriend," and then, "Oh, you're not. How is your mom's basement?" You know, I would always kind of go down that road of like, can I get a show of hands from women? Who isn't crazy about this guy? And just ask me to take his shirt off. And like, and I would do votes and then talk about like, "Wow, you have no takers." And it would dissolve from there. But on a selfish note, I also thought, out of 4 minutes, I've taken 2 minutes doing something that makes me feel bad about myself, because you'd watch the person finally be truly embarrassed enough to stop talking. And then you're looking at this guy who, even though I think he's a jerk and should have been quiet to begin with, now he actually feels bad, like to his core. And then I'm supposed to somehow transition to like, "So I was walking down Madison Avenue," and you're just like, "How, what?" First of all, there's no real good transition there. And then now I've got 2 minutes left.
At the Oscars, if you go over time, they're going to play you off stage. Is there somebody, there was a comedy club owner, like tapping his watch and saying, "Time's up, Melissa"?
Oh, my God. No, there's the light. Ever-present, not to ever not be heated light that the first time I went up, I didn't know what the light meant.
What it flashes, like time's up?
Yes. And when that light flashes, it is literally like, finish your sentence and get off stage. You have 10 seconds before, you know, the stage explodes. It is really a big deal. It's a big deal to the owner or manager who's ever running the night. It's also a huge deal to the other comics, because you don't get to suddenly do 8 minutes if we all get four. And
you're the stealing first other people's time.
You're stealing it. Yeah, you're taking it out of, they're going to get less. But the first time I did stand up, people actually laughed at something, much to my surprise. And as they laughed, he flashed the light from the booth. And I thought it was kind of a nonverbal applause from the manager.
Kind of like a rim shot.
I thought he was saying like, "Atta girl, you know," like, "keep it up." It was the first time that I'd seen him flash a light, and it happened right on a laugh. So then he continued flashing it, which I thought he meant, "Keep it up. It's going great." So I kept talking and the light kept flashing, and I thought, boy, this guy really likes me. He's really encouraging me. And then I finally did get off the stage, I can't remember if he came out and was like, his arms were flailing, or finally I was just like, I don't know what else to say. I've been up here for like 9 minutes. And I came off and I just remembered him screaming at me in a hallway, asking me what's the matter with me, how dumb can I be? And I was like, I thought you were encouraging me, which I think blew his mind that I was like so naive. That I truly didn't know.
So you're one of the women who has taken on like producing and writing films. And has mm-hmm. that been an attempt to make sure that you can act in material that means something to you, that you care about, and give yourself good roles? Because, you know, I think it's often hard for women to get good roles.
I think it is. And I think, you know, I want to be a part of making these three-dimensional, flawed, often challenging, but to me, really real women. I just thought so many things I read were kind of, I don't even know what in the breakdown you would describe them as, pleasant. I was like, I don't know how to play pleasant. Like, what? Who cares? There's nothing to sink your teeth into. It's like the perfect clothes, and they look really nice, and they have a nice relationship, and their house is. I just thought, oh my God, like who wants to watch that? I didn't want to play it. I also thought all the people I love and like are filled with quirks and eccentricities, and isn't that why we always love or even dislike people? It's like we're a bundle of all these different weirdnesses. And so often I felt that everything I read for a female character was really bland and often a bummer, just kind of everyone's having fun, and then in would come the woman to go like, Carl or Sam, Bill. I thought, oh my God, how many times can I just randomly walk into a room and say the guy's name? I'm like, why doesn't she ever walk in and go like, what's going on? This is fun. It's like, why is she always a bummer? I didn't know how to play it. I felt like I don't have the skill set to play this because I don't know why she's doing it.
Well, Melissa McCarthy, I want to thank you so much for coming on our show. I've greatly enjoyed it. I love you in your new role, and Can You Ever Forgive Me? And let's continue the conversation some other time.
I would love to. This has been just a dream. I love the show, so thanks so much for having me on.
Melissa McCarthy stars in the new film Can You Ever Forgive Me? As a writer turned literary forger. In the 1980s, music producer Hal Wilner masterminded four tribute anthologies in which various jazz and pop bands played music by Thelonious Monk or Kurt Weill or songs from Walt Disney musicals. The first and least known of those tribute albums, featuring music Nino Rota composed for Federico Fellini movies, has now been reissued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it set the template.
Francis Haynes on steel drums and Sharon Freeman on French horns on Freeman's arrangement of music from La Dolce Vita. It's on the just reissued Amarcord Nino Rota from 1981, where diverse musicians play Rota music from Fellini films. One highlight is bandleader Carla Bley's long suite from 8 1/2. Rota's melodies feed her own taste for circusy excess, shifting instrumental colors, sideways harmonies, and ballroom dance beats. Nina Rota's music sounds like hers already. We'll be right back. That music suggests how much Carla Bley and Nino Rota inspired the madcap Dutch band leader Willem Broeker. Film scores can get repetitious, Rota's included, but arrangers can always vary the instrumentation when melodies come back. Another distinguished jazz composer, Mulhall Richard Abrams, keeps recasting a line on his section of a suite from La Dolce Vita. Conceiving this project, producer Hal Willner heard how it could work. Nino Rota's musical personality was so strong, in his Fellini scores especially, as long as the musicians minded his melodies, all the diverse approaches would fit together. That same suite moves on from Mulhall to a segment for rock stars, singer Deborah Harry and guitarist Chris Stein from the band Blondie. That's not the only suite on the album Amarcord Nino Rota to cut across genres. David Amram, the New York classical scene's hippest hipster, starts in one world and ends in another, setting music for Fellini's ancient Roman grotesque, Satyricon. Jerry Dagian on flute and Ray Mantilla on congas. The anthology Amarcord Nino Rota was proof of concept for producer Hal Willner. He'd repeat the idea in grander style, notably on the first sequel, That's the Way I Feel Now, a tribute to Thelonious Monk. There is more here, including a rather Charles Mingus-y medley arranged by William Fisher, showcasing Mingus tenor George Adams, flanked by new arrivals Winton and Branford Marsalis. There are also solo pieces from saxophonist Steve Lacy, vibraphonist Dave Samuels, guitarist Bill Frizzell, and a very early appearance on record, and teasing piano virtuoso Jackie Byard. Amarcord Nino Rota is a charming album whose overdue return was worth the wait.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure. He reviewed the reissue Amarcord Nino Rota. Coming up, we hear from Paul Dano, who played a teenaged preacher in There Will Be Blood, and a moody teenager who took a vow of silence in Little Miss Sunshine. Dano directed and co-wrote the new film adaptation of Richard Ford's novel Wildlife, which stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Carey Mulligan. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Paul Dano is probably best known for his performance in There Will Be Blood as a teenaged evangelical preacher. Imagine being in your early 20s and working on that film with director Paul Thomas Anderson and actor Daniel Day-Lewis. Dano was only 12 when he had a part in the Broadway revival of Inherit the Wind, starring George C. Scott. Dano also co-starred in the films Little Miss Sunshine, 12 Years a Slave, and portrayed Brian Wilson in the film Love and Mercy. Now at the age of 34, he's directed his first film called Wildlife. The screenplay, which Dano co-wrote with his partner Zoe Kazan, is adapted from a Richard Ford novel of the same name. Wildlife is about a 14-year-old boy, Joe, who has recently moved with his parents to a small town in Montana. He hasn't yet made friends, and he's looking to his parents for a sense of home and stability. But his father, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, loses his job and his sense of purpose. The mother, played by Carey Mulligan, takes a part-time job to help make ends meet. Meanwhile, it's wildfire season, and the father decides to join the men fighting the fire, which leaves his wife and son to fend for themselves during the indeterminate period he'll be gone. And that changes everything. Just as fires can get out of control, so can people's lives. Here's the scene in which Joe comes home from school to find his father breaking the news to his mother that he's leaving them to fight the wildfires.
Sorry I'm late.
Talk to your father. Tell him not to act like a fool.
I am not being foolish. I put my name on a list. I waited for my chance, and now they finally have a place for me.
You don't know anything about fires. You'll get burned up.
Well, I've been reading about them. I know enough.
You've been reading about them? You've been studying up?
Don't turn my words on me, Gene.
Dad, what's going on?
Your father is leaving us to go and fight those wildfires.
What? Dad, why?
Answer him, Terry. You won't take a job at a grocery store, but you'll go out with a bunch of deadbeats and risk getting killed.
Yeah, I have to go there and leave it.
What does it pay?
What?
What does it pay?
Dollar an hour.
Oh, my God. Terry, listen, you don't have to do this. I'm working
now. No, but it won't be for long.
What if, not if you get yourself killed?
It's going to snow. The fire's going to go out. They're going to send everybody home.
What if it never snows at all?
Joe, what do you think? Is this a bad idea?
Don't ask him. He'll prove anything.
He's almost grown. He has a say in what happens in this family.
Your father's burned up and you never see him again.
What? Don't say that, Gene!
You can't keep running every time something doesn't go your way.
Please, you don't know what I'm doing.
Don't I? I'm a grown woman, Jerry. Why don't you act like a grown man?
Paul Dano, congratulations on making this film and welcome to Fresh Air. So this film is adapted from a Richard Ford novel that, like your movie, is called Wildlife. How did you first find the novel and why did you fall in love with it?
I was a fan of Richard Ford's. I had just read a book called Rock Springs, which is a beautiful collection of short stories. And I went to the bookstore in Brooklyn called Book Court, which is now closed, looking for another book of his. Opened up Wildlife, and honestly, from the first sentence, even the first paragraph remains probably one of my favorite in any book ever, so I was sort of immediately in just as a reader. I mean, not I'm going to make a film, but wow, this book is for me.
Would you read the first paragraph from the novel, which we happen to have sitting on the table here?
Sure. In the fall of 1960, when I was 16 and my father was for a time not working, my mother met a man named Warren Miller and fell in love with him. This was in Great Falls, Montana, at the time of the Gypsy Basin oil boom, and my father had brought us there in the spring of that year from Lewiston, Idaho, in the belief that people, small people like him, were making money in Montana or soon would be, and he wanted a piece of that good luck before all of it collapsed and was gone in the wind.
Thank you.
I mean, the language is
I'm a big Richard Ford fan.
Beautiful.
Yes, I agree. So tell us more about what you related to in the story of this. There's the writing, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
But you were adapting the story. So what was it about the story that spoke to you?
So even about 20 pages into the book, there's a paragraph about a kid watching his mom teach swim class. And thinking that everybody around her thinks, oh, there's a woman with a good smile, or there's a woman with a good figure, or there's a woman who's happy, and he knew something was wrong at home. And at that point, my heart sort of leapt, and I was like, wow, this is, as great writing can do, or a great song, or whatever it is, it felt like it's for you in some way. And that, I just remember, I moved to a new town when I was 14. Your home is sort of the edge of the world when you move somewhere new, because you don't know what's outside of it, you don't have friends yet. you know, school is not yet a release. It's sort of scary to go there for the first time. And so we grew up in a one-bedroom apartment in Manhattan. I'm really close with my family, maybe too close. And I remember when my parents started having, you know, struggles in their relationship, sort of what a profound and, I guess, difficult moment that was for me. So this book sort of reflected back to me how family is one of the greatest loves in our life. And because of that, it's also sometimes one of the greatest sources of struggle in our life. And he was able to capture that with compassion.
In the clip that we just heard, the parents are fighting, and one of them says to the teenage boy, "What do you think, Joe?" I'm like, how awkward is that, asking a teenage boy to weigh in on the battle between his parents? Were you in that position?
Well, I think so, and I think that's something I related to in this character. I think somebody else might have wanted to make a film about a kid who rebels, right, or something from their youth. That's, for me, I remember sort of standing in the middle, feeling the ground shake, and not wanting things to tip. So Joe and I have something in common, and Richard Ford and I have something in common in that regard. I was somebody who wanted to keep things together. So if something like that had been posed to me, you know, I wouldn't have said, I'm, you know, out of here, and like whatever, you know, I would have tried to actually understand what was going on and can I help?
Did your parents separate?
Well, my parents have an interesting situation, which is they separated. They, like the end of this book, strangely, which is not the end of the film, have resumed living together a few years ago. They never got officially divorced, but we did not always live together.
Let's talk about your acting, and let's start with There Will Be Blood. You gave such an amazing performance in this. You're a teen evangelical preacher in a small, poor town in Southern California, turn of the 20th century, during the early days when they're discovering that there's oil there. And there's an oil man, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, who's a bit of a con man and also an incredible capitalist, who comes to town and wants to get as much of the oil there as possible. You want some money from oil, and you and he become antagonists. And in one scene, the scene we're going to hear, he's basically told by one landowner that he'll sign over the oil rights to Daniel Day-Lewis if Daniel Day-Lewis agrees to be baptized by you in your makeshift church. So this is the scene where you're baptizing him, and I should just say parenthetically that the Daniel Day-Lewis character, earlier in the film, he's taken in a boy whose father was killed in a mining accident, and then when the boy goes deaf as a result of another oil accident, Daniel Day-Lewis sends him away to a school. Okay, so here's the scene with my guest Paul Dano and Daniel Day-Lewis.
We have a sinner with us here who wishes for salvation. Daniel, are you a sinner?
Yes.
Oh, the Lord can hear you, Daniel. Say it to him. Go ahead and speak to him. It's all right.
Yes.
Down on your knees. And to him. Look up to the sky and say it.
What do you want me to say?
Oh, Daniel, you've come here and you've brought good and wealth, but you have also brought your bad habits as a backslider. You've lusted after women, and you have abandoned your child. Your child that you raised, you have abandoned all because he was sick and you have sinned. So say it now. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
Say it louder. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
Louder, Daniel. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
I am sorry, Lord.
I am sorry, Lord.
I want the blood.
I want the blood.
You have abandoned your child.
I've abandoned my child.
I will never backslide.
I will never backslide.
I was lost, but now I am found.
I was lost, but now I'm found.
I have abandoned my child. Say it. Say it.
I've abandoned my child.
Say it louder. Say it louder.
I've abandoned my child. I've abandoned my child. I've abandoned my boy.
Beg for the blood.
Give me the blood, Eli. Let me get out of here. Give me the blood, Lord, and let me get away.
Do you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior?
Yes, I do.
Get out of here, devil! Out, devil! Out, sin! Do you accept the Church of the Third Revelation as your spiritual guide? Do you? Get out of here! Get out of here! Get out of this! Do you accept Jesus Christ as your Savior?
Yes, I do.
Wow. That's Paul Dano and Daniel Day-Lewis in a scene from the 2007 film There Will Be Blood. I should mention here the slapping sounds that you're hearing at the end of that scene. That's Paul Dano's character, like, slapping the devil, slapping the devil out of Daniel Day-Lewis. Also getting even with Daniel Day-Lewis, who has beaten him up earlier in the film. That scene, it's almost like this incredible operatic duet. Did you think of it that way when you were making it?
It was sort of intense just to hear that. You know, that it's been some time for me. I was sort of cast at the last minute in this, and I started about 4 days after I was cast in this part.
You were initially cast as the preacher's brother.
Yeah.
And then they moved you to be
the
teen preacher. Is that why those two characters became twins? Were they not twins before?
They were just brothers.
They were just brothers, but now that you were playing both roles. So they saw something in you where they wanted you to play the bigger part.
Yeah, I suppose so, but you know,
why?
I mean, sort of why I was going back there is just listening to that clip, you know, gave me a feeling, which was I just remember the 2 days before I started spending sunup to sundown in that church alone, you know, Eli's church. And that was a really sort of beautiful couple days, just sort of trying to learn the script and make contact with the character and in this empty church. I don't know why that's what I went back to.
It was your idea to learn your part while sitting in the church?
Well, I was just suddenly on location and I was like, day one is Monday, and okay, I'm just going to go to the church and learn my scenes. Mm-hmm. It's funny because that clip too, quite a long scene, so that was a sort of a scene we filmed for all day long, and I believe our first setup was probably some kind of wider, maybe some kind of master shot, and I slapped Daniel, as you said, towards the end of the scene, and I think we were supposed to, once we get to that part, just stop, you know, because we're going to be shooting this all day, and I remember the first take forgetting and just slapping him many times. And as soon as we cut, I remembered that I was supposed to stop. And I went, oh, God. And I think I had nicked his eye even. He had a little bit of red in his eye. And you know, I was, oh, my God, what is that? And he just said, that's how you do it. You know, and I was like, okay.
So you started acting in community theater when you were how old?
I mean, I started in school before that, and then we moved from Manhattan to Connecticut in third grade, and probably shortly after that.
Okay. At what point did you know you wanted to do this professionally?
Because I started young, I knew I did not want to go to conservatory after high school.
Why did you know that?
Because the young acting world, I think there were things that I was aware of that I felt like, I don't know if that's the healthiest.
But like money, celebrity.
Exactly.
Being in a bubble.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think I always needed the other part of my life, like friends and music or like basketball. You know, like that's an important balance point to who I am. So I just didn't want to be around all actors, is the simplest way to put it, because that was already a big part of my life. So I went to college as an English major basically to kind of double check, like, hey, let's make sure that you're just, you know, the train's already moving. I needed to know I could get off, so to speak. I had already done a film called LIE when I was 16. It did well for an independent film. I was lucky to have an agent and to sort of have one little foot in the door. But I needed to know that it was me and my choice. Sort of studying something else, being a deluded poet for a moment, or, you know, mm-hmm. reading the great Russian novels or whatever, kind of helped me, you know, go, okay, you know what? Actually, I miss, you know, that, and I like it, and I want to do it. And frankly, it was getting the part in a film called The Ballad of Jack and Rose when I was 18. We filmed it when I was 19, that Daniel Day-Lewis is in. And that was the first time on film I got to play a character that was not my like myself, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I had just done a couple parts where I was like a dorky guy with glasses, which I, you know, sort of am in real life. And I felt like that's not acting to me. Like, I don't want to just be a version of myself. And I was worried because I didn't know yet that you had a choice to say yes or no to a part. And getting somebody believing in me to play this part in Battle Jack and Rose made me go, oh, I can be an actor. Like, this is what I want.
So I was reading an interview with your partner, Zoe Kazan, and congratulations, you both have a little baby now.
Thanks.
And she was comparing some of the gender differences between her world as an actress and your world as an actor. So she said 9 times out of 10 in a role, she has to cry, and that you rarely have to cry. And that once in an audition, she had to have a gun and be tough. And you've had a lot of auditions that have involved guns or being tough. Are you ever, like, frustrated with the number of movies involving, like, guns and violence? And
well, yeah, I am personally, you know, even as a viewer, and I've always myself chosen to look at it like the why part of it. So, a film like Prisoners has violence, right? But I think that there's a sense of morality. I actually think it's conflicted. You know, your lead character is responding in a violent way, and I don't think it's looked upon, you know, with shiny eyes. That's, I think, maybe it's okay. You know, I hope I'm not just justifying it. But, I mean, I try to look at things and go, what's the cost of this? You know, 12 Years a Slave, there's a lot of violence, but this is, you know, a story that has value. And I'm also, frankly, like, actually a little squeamish. Even though I've done a lot of dark material emotionally, I don't respond well to just violence for violence sake. You know, that's not my...
So what does make you squeamish?
Well, blood, actually. And I think the older I get, the worse it is. Actually, it's not like something where you become more... It actually becomes more uneasy for me, especially now being a parent, right? Like, seeing the first breath of life taken and to watch life expire so easily again and again, you know, on screen. I do think entertainment's okay, though, and I just think it's about how people handle it, right?
So your partner, Zoe Kazan, just gave birth a couple of months ago. That's messy. Were you squeamish about that?
Well, I thought I would be, and I wasn't, and I loved it. I thought it was incredible. I mean, Zoe was doing a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And I thought it was absolutely incredible.
Paul Dano, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on your new film.
Thank you.
Paul Dano co-wrote and directed the new film adaptation of the Richard Ford novel Wildlife. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.